At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Survivor Specialist John and McKenna are back on Thursdays. We are back to our original day because we had a conflict for tomorrow. But we are here still rewinding the episode, and we got some things to talk about today.
I think we're at a point in the season where everyone is starting to wonder, where is season 48 going? Because this felt like the most predictable. As soon as I saw the splits for this week, when Mike Bloom posted them last week, I was like, oh, okay, Say and Cedric are going.
Okay, but I feel like I'm still shocked that Say went home.
Interesting. Please elaborate.
Because Say has been, like, everyone has tried to get Say out this entire time, and she just finds a way. So I didn't believe it until Say's torch was actually being snuffed. And even then, I'm like, just only because I have Australian Survivor, like, so in my head, I was like, she's gonna walk down this path and there's gonna be some sort of bullcrap coming at her where she's not actually voted out. Like, I just couldn't believe that she actually got voted out.
Yeah, it did kind of come as a shock, and especially just because of the way the episode was edited. It got so heavy-handed with the way they were pitching these people. Usually, when you're watching Survivor and you see an edit like we did of Shaheen last night, or Mitch last night, where it's talking about getting them out so much, it's pretty obvious that they're not the one going home at that point. But I found myself questioning, is this just so overly, like, heavy-handed so that we think that they're not going home because they are going home? Is that what's happening here?
I thought it was possible for Shaheen to go home because he had the confessional of, everybody needs me for a vote. And that almost feels like that, you know, death confessional where it's like, you know, what could go wrong? Everything.
Yeah, it did kind of feel that way. I'm kind of glad it didn't happen that way, though, because I do think Shaheen is providing some entertainment on this season, and I think we're about to see this fall of Shaheen, but I don't know when it's going to happen, and I'm very intrigued to see how it'll happen. I know Phil and Will were talking about just the idea of, like, the strong five. Is this a strong five that can really ride it to the final five? There's potential for sure, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think we'll see some sort of disruption in it. But because of that, because, you know, Say happens to be in the group that goes before or has someone not being on the jury, I think it's the only reason Say ends up going here. But clearly, I think if you can expect any new era person on 50 at this point, it has to be Say. Like, I have to imagine that is the only reason she got so many confessionals, because it almost feels, and, like, again, I don't want to say this, like, it's not a negative connotation here, but it almost feels like Russell Hansen Samoa, where we are being fed this character the entire time just because we're going to see them again right afterwards.
I mean, maybe. Speaking of Say, we are going to go into our outwit moment. And we're talking about, like, hinky votes, burn votes, votes that kind of just aren't for the majority and have, like, an ulterior motive to them of whether they feel bad and don't want to pile on, things like that. So with Say here, she votes for Cedric in that last tribal council, and it's basically just to get him back because she knew Charity was going to be the one going home. She thought she would have, like, a vote or two, not as many as she did. And threw her vote toward Cedric, made it a nice scripty font. And he is now worried about this one vote cast against him.
I want to say, I hate it because I have to say as a verb and as a proper noun here, but say switching to cursive for this. This is one of those things that I think we kind of take for granted as Survivor viewers sometimes, where obviously you don't know who's actually casting the votes when you're on the island. You can make your assumptions. You can kind of figure it out. If people tell you, then you have an idea. But a lot of this does come down from being able to deduce people's handwriting.
Yep.
And say, knowing that Cedric has seen her handwriting for 4 votes at this point and would be able to, four votes at this point, would be able to discern what it was. Switching to cursive for this, just to throw it off and kind of create chaos, is such a say move. Like, this is exactly what I would expect out of a player like Say to do, and is probably why Say is cut before the jury, because it's so unpredictable, but so calculated at the same time. This is such an in Survivor history, McKenna, because we don't get hinky votes in Survivor. It's not, and I think there's kind of this nature to voting that we see in the big social strategy reality TV shows, because we have, obviously we have Survivor, where everyone's votes and almost everyone is eligible for the vote, with the exception of whoever has individual immunity. And you have, whereas you have Big Brother, where there are 2 people eligible for votes, which made it so that hinky votes were kind of more of a thing. We see more dogpiling in Big Brother a lot of time because they want to stick with the house. And then occasionally you throw a hinky vote to make things a little more interesting, create tension in the house. Or then you have something like The Challenge, where we see people burn votes a lot of the time because they don't want to make enemies. And we've seen moments in The Challenge where voting for someone else is like voting for the person who you're not trying not to vote for.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of why we don't see hinky votes in Survivor a lot of the time.
Because your vote is just vote so matters. Yeah, the vote just matters more. And like, you can always, like with The Challenge, there's like, you're voting someone into elimination. So they're not gone yet because they can always come back. Mm-hmm. But with in Survivor, it's happened before, Redemption Island, blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting here, and I'm going to bring up Ceri. She threw like a strategy vote on Sierra in Game Changers, Sierra Dawn Thomas in Game Changers, to kind of put her in the forefront of people's minds, because in the following episode, she has a conversation with Sarah on the hammock and is like, you know, I think Sierra and Brad are running the game. And so then, someone voted for Sierra. And Ceri says in her voting confessional for that, being like, this is a game move. And I know you're not going home, but I need to place my vote here.
Yeah, it's a very interesting move by Ceri. And again, it does show that next level of thinking that Ceri has as a player, and why, you know, we talk so highly about Ceri as probably the best player who's never won Survivor, because this is something that seems so innocuous. And I think that's why it's not really a Survivor strategy, because doing that doesn't tend to get that thought process going. Like, we see it in Big Brother. And this is why voting in Survivor and Big Brother is different than The Challenge as well, because in The Challenge, a lot of the time your votes are public. And you're doing it in front of everyone, so everyone knows who you're voting. That's why we see burn votes in The Challenge, because it's a public vote. You are saying something out loud. In Survivor, things are a little trickier because your vote is obscure. It's hidden. But there is one thing you can always guarantee. If you cast a vote for someone, even if they don't get home, Jeff will read it.
Yeah.
And that is what Ceri is taking advantage of here, because Ceri in this episode is trying to rally the troops to take Zeke out, but instead sees that Culpepper and Sierra are kind of starting to run the show a little bit, and is really concerned about how close Sarah is getting to them, and needs to put this idea into Sarah's head. Sierra is someone we need to think about.
Yep.
And she does it simply by putting pen to parchment, putting it out there. She knew who was going home in this vote. She knew her vote would be inconsequential, but she still leveraged the vote. And this is another thing, right? The power of the vote extends past just who you're voting out, because you can use it as this kind of like subconscious trigger in people to make them think, why did that name come out? This could have a result of Sierra kind of reacting negatively to it and getting a little more boisterous, trying to figure out who put this vote on her, because it seemingly comes out of nowhere, which then can stir up some tension and make it so that people are thinking about her more. Or it could literally just be like, someone did that. Why did someone do that?
Yeah. I mean, to your first response of it, where someone could, you know, be boisterous and loud, we're going to go over to T-Bird putting her vote on Lex, because she didn't want to have it be a complete dog pile on Clarence. So she votes for Lex, and then they come back to camp, and all the next day, Lex is furious. He doesn't know why he got another vote. He's on a witch hunt. And that just kind of puts a bad taste about Lex in people's mouths. They still, you know, have work with him and things like that. But it's still, he is on this witch hunt. It drives Kelly Goldsmith away from that alliance because he insists that it's her. And she's like, you know what? If you don't believe me, I'm out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting because this isn't a hinky vote, right? It's not a vote that is cast to stir things up. But I think because of when this happens in Survivor history, this is kind of the vote that shows you the power of a hinky vote. Because casting, T-Bird's just, Teresa's just throwing this vote out on Lex. She knows Clarence is voting that way. She knows he's already getting a vote, so it's not like it's coming out of nowhere. And she just feels kind of bad for Clarence.
Yeah.
For getting all of the votes. And you know what? It's a respectable thing to be like, hey, okay, whatever. Like, you don't need to dogpile. It's fine. But and T-Bird says this herself in her special. There's no way you could gauge what Lex's response to this was going to be. Lex's response is so aggressive. It is so paranoid. And the thing is, Lex is a player who feels like he always knows what's going on. So when he sees that vote and he's like, oh, whatever drove him to get to the point where it's like, it must have been Kelly. This vote thrown on Lex by T-Bird determined the rest of the game.
Yeah.
Because this is the moment, because Lex is like, no, Kelly's going home now, immediately. She's lying. And that's the power of this. Like the suggestion from a vote. The suggestion from a vote is enough to drive someone to such paranoia that it completely changes the way they approach the game.
And this is also the era of, like, I wouldn't say like alliances, but like groupthink, where it's like, oh, all right, so like we're working together and we're always voting together until we get to the final whatever. So, like, when they had that and someone defected, then it's like, we have a traitor. We have to get this person out. So, I mean, T-Bird for traitors?
Maybe. I mean, I'd settle for T-Bird for 50 instead. But I think the interesting thing with this exact example, though, is people, I think people who haven't watched Africa recently kind of forget how tight Kelly was in with those boys.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of a wild heel turn it is here to see Lex just flip it on her as quickly as possible, get her out.
Mm-hmm.
And T-Bird sees everything that's going on, is like, I'm just gonna
back away. It's like the Homer Simpson in the hedge meme. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. And then, all right, also want to bring up, because I feel like we can't not talk about this, but we don't have any video proof anywhere. What the hell, Rita? Voting for Earl.
I mean, we have a little bit of proof. She has the quarantine questionnaire that she did with Dalton Ross during the...
We don't have video proof of it.
No, we don't have video proof, but we do have a little bit of evidence. This is maybe the most infuriating random vote in Survivor history.
Yeah.
And maybe some people don't know why. This vote, first off, tanks Rita's game. Rita is completely sunk after this. It was one of the worst decisions ever made. And it all comes down to the fact that she didn't want to vote for Sylvia nor Anthony, who were the people who were getting the votes.
And, just vote for one of them.
And because she's like, I'm just going to throw a vote on Earl, she breaks her trust with her entire tribe. No one can trust her. And she goes home right afterwards. This vote prevents Earl from getting the first perfect game in Survivor history.
Yeah. But, like, why didn't they show us the vote?
Maybe because at that point you don't need to, like, know about it, right? But it would be nice to see the voting special. That is for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, this way they can kind of maintain the illusion. Back then, way before, we were all scouring the internet all times. I mean, yes, okay, Survivor Sucks still existed, but before everyone was scouring the internet all the time and could find information like this, you could make it through all of Fiji and just be like, who voted for Earl and ruined his perfect game and not know.
That's true. Alrighty, so we're going to move on to outplay now, and we are talking endurance records. In this challenge, we see David surpass the record set by Gabler, and John and I were talking about this where when we were planning the podcast, where it's actually the second place person that determines the record, and I was thinking about it, and like my mind was like blown, and it would have been so interesting if David was like, I beat the record, but I want to actually set the record. Jeff, we're just chilling for a little while longer. That would have been so funny.
And obviously, Survivor doesn't work that way. There's a schedule that has to be upheld.
No, I know.
I thought we were going to come in with a mind-shattering opinion on records in challenges and how it's actually the second-place person who determines what the record is, but the first-place person who holds them. And then Tyson goes and talks about it on his podcast. So here we are, McKenna. We try to be the forefront, but sometimes coming out as the later podcast makes us look like the follower instead. But it was in fact said during our planning session last night, right after the episode.
Phil does it to us all the time. So, I mean, at least this one was Tyson.
That's true. I do feel a little bit better than that about that. It's so interesting looking at this because this is a challenge that, again, we saw the record set recently. It's Gabler. It was only 5 seasons ago. And that was obviously that big moment with Gabler listing off literally every person he knows as an acknowledgement there. And in contrast, we have David. Looks like he just does this every day. It did not look like David was ever losing this challenge.
No. And I think maybe one thing that might set David apart with this challenge is you see that people aren't really struggling with the weight. It's the grip. And David must do like grip and strength training with his hands or something like that, because we saw like that grip was strong and that bucket like didn't move.
Yeah.
I mean, it moved a little bit. They commented on it, but like it moved what, like a few inches in however many minutes?
Yeah, it was impressive. And again, David wasn't trying. He was holding it with one hand a lot of the times that they showed us.
Yeah.
Where you had people struggling the entire time. And take it, like, I have terrible grip strength. I would suck so much at this challenge.
I'd be Cedric.
Still weigh quite a bit. So, like, that would also, I'm not going to tell you exactly how much that 25% of my body weight would be right now, but let's just say it's a lot more than everyone on that island. Okay, not a lot more anymore, but still. The point being is, it's heavy, right? And that's why we usually see the lean, strong person win this. So to see the big, strong person win this it just really goes to show how much stronger David is than everyone else.
Yeah.
And Joe, for that matter. Because again, like we said, Joe's kind of the person who makes it so that David sets the record. Joe lasts a long time in the shower as well.
So one that we thought of was like, all right, get a grip, right? We have Ozzy who lasts for forever, and then Ty has to beat his record, right? Because Ty lasts longer than him in Game Changers. But it's actually not the time record that Ty beats him. Ty beats Ozzy in his own challenge. Every time Ozzy has played this challenge, he wins it. So the third time he plays this challenge, what do we expect? Ozzy to win this. But Ty also won this in Ko Rong. So this is actually a really great battle between these guys. And they are the final two left on the polls. And Ozzy falls, well, drops, and Ty winds up winning the challenge here. But Ozzy still holds the time record. But Ty defeats Ozzy's win record.
It's so awkward because, like, there aren't many people who have been able to win the same immunity challenge twice. In fact, there are only three in the history of Survivor. It's Ozzy with Get a Grip, it's Parvati with When It Rains, It Pours, and it's Keith Nail with Take the Reins. And it's so fascinating to look at it because, yeah, Ozzy holds this record of I am the greatest person at this. I have the greatest accumulated time in this challenge. In Cook Islands, he lasts 2 hours and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. In South Pacific, when he's doing the duel against Brandon, he lasts 40 minutes. And in Game Changers, he still lasts an hour 35. This is the awkward thing about these timed records, though, in Survivor. And it's more convenient now when Jeff is literally telling us, okay, you just passed the record.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell what these records are because you kind of just have to go after timestamps.
Yep.
And whatever producers are telling you when it happens. Now, generally, they give you a timestamp at about the time that something happens. So it becomes a little obvious there. But again, we don't have an exact time. It's not like we can get this record down to the second.
Mm-hmm.
For all these other ones that Jeff isn't telling us about in the episode. And with Get a Grip, we assume Ozzy has the record for it because he has the longest time that we know of with 2 hours and 15 minutes in Cook Islands. However, the first time this challenge premiered in Vanuatu, we don't have a time for how long that challenge lasted.
And what's also interesting that when you brought that up, when we were looking, we were like, well, Parvati has the record for When It Rains, It Pours. Has to with 6 hours.
Yeah. No.
Let's talk back to T-Bird here, staying up there also for 6 hours, but they didn't give us down to the second. On the wiki, it says they are tied for the record at 6 hours. And I'm like, that is absolutely impossible. Unless they got down at the same millisecond, someone holds the record for this challenge, but it is logged as both of them holding the record at 6 hours.
And the most interesting thing about this scenario, neither of them outlasted the last person they played against.
Right. Clarence got down off of rock, paper, scissors, and they were trying to shove Jason Siska down to make friends and give everyone food. Like, it's crazy with this challenge. At 6 hours, they don't duel it out. They're like, no, we're just going to let, like, this game or whatever it is decide the record or whatever, or decide who goes down and wins first place.
So, really, yes, T-Bird and Parvati technically hold the record for this challenge, but can we say almost like no one holds the record for this challenge because of it?
What?
No one holds the record because of it, right? Like, we don't have a determinant winner in this challenge because neither of them have gone to the point. Neither of them have been forced, like David was with Joe competing against him, to set a record, right?
That's true.
Because the person's always stepped down. So it's fascinating. It's just a weird circumstance for this exact challenge.
Okay, well, you want definite records? The first thing that came to my head when we were going to do endurance records is shoulder the load. And this is one of my favorite Survivor challenges, where you have the pole and you keep adding weights to them. And Jim Rice and Brandon Hance break the record in South Pacific that was previously held by Rupert in Pearl Islands and tied by JT and Brendan in Token Jeans. The record is 240 pounds. That broke 220.
So this is also a really interesting one, because first off, this is one where we have a concrete visualization of things, right? Like, we're not just taking the producer's word. I mean, we have to take the producer's word a little bit, because we have to take their word as to what each of the bags weighs. But we have a visual representation of how much weight they're bearing on their shoulders, because we can literally see how many bags are on the poles, and it's impressive. It is impressive to stand there with 240 pounds across your back. Trust me, it is. Now, there's a bit of a caveat with this one, McKenna.
Yes and no, because we talked challenge variations last week. So I'd say the sandbag version of shoulder the load is different than the water version of shoulder the load in Australia.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because technically, if we're looking at it, presumably based on what we know about, you know, the mass of water and how much water is being held by Colby and Scoopin in that challenge, they're probably holding close to 400 pounds of water. And it's enough water, because remember, the thing is like, we're not talking about weight, because it isn't like the equal weight or anything like that. But there's so much weight that the pole snaps on Scoop's back.
No, yeah. They do hold like a different amount of weight. You're right. But it's like such a different challenge, because there's like that balance, the balance beam, and they got their tribe mates like throwing water on their poles and running back and all of that. So I feel like, yes, there is that technicality a little bit, but at the same time, I would give Jim and Brandon the full, like, kudos of you broke this record.
They officially hold the record. It's stated in the episode, therefore it's there.
Jim Rice and Brandon to beat someone like Rupert at this kind of challenge, because Rupert is, like, this big, burly guy. And you expect him to, you know, keep a record like this. It would occur to me to be like, oh yeah, Brandon, Jim Rice, crushing it.
Yeah, for sure. And this is one of those things. But if you look at Brandon and Jim Rice, they're the right type of guys you would expect to do well at the challenge. Like the stockier guys, a little lower to the ground, little bit stronger base there. It makes a lot of sense that they were ultimately the people to come out ahead in the challenge.
And no one has beat Krista for the female record at 160 pounds for just the women. She's tied with Osten and Savage. And she has a bunch of people below her as well, like Tyson's below her. And that's crazy that in season 7, she continued to hold the record.
Have we ever had another female compete in this challenge?
Yeah, we had Stacy, we had Dawn, Taj, and Debbie.
Okay. Yeah, it's impressive. It is,
because
60 pounds is not a lot.
In Pearl Islands, they didn't require male, female. Then after Pearl Islands, they required two men, one woman.
Okay, that makes sense. But McKenna, there's a portion of last night's episode that really tickled my funny bone.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And honestly, for a repeat challenge, where we're seeing the exact same challenge at the exact same point in the game that we saw last season, which we complain about enough, but it was so fun because of how much fun the editors were having with it. Because Jeff asks for music and Shaheen delivers. And the editors take it and they put it into the, they get the composer to build the music around what Shaheen's doing. This is, I was literally falling over laughing. I was having such a good time watching this challenge.
Yeah. So this is our outlast moment. Surprise, everyone. We're at that point in the episode. And talking about this moment where we're in the age of super fans, and so they know kind of what the music cues are, what, you know, the theme song is, where they're going to do X, Y, or Z. And it's always so fun when they bring in this kind of, you know, meta into the episode. They're bringing the post-production into the actual production, and it's, you know, so fun where Shaheen knows, like, yeah, we're gonna have this, like, deep chanting right here. This is, I feel it. And
yeah,
you know what, Shaheen? Yes, you're right.
He was, and he delivered 100%. And it's so fascinating because when we talk about, like, the meta sense of Survivor, we're often talking about, especially now in the new era, we're talking about the game, right? We're talking about the meta of the game. The idea that I understand how the game is played, I understand the strategy of it, I am applying the strategy from previous seasons of Survivor to the game. So for us to get a moment where we get to talk about, like, the meta of Survivor from a television standpoint instead, from a, hey, this is something that, like, in a scripted episode of television is a reference to the show and makes it so that, like, it plays on the viewership and knows that, the viewers are watching. We're at a point in Survivor where we get to do that, where we get that moment of, hey, this is how I know this will happen here. I am going to do it. It'll probably be this funny moment, probably won't even make the editing room floor. No, the editors are willing to run with it and make it even more meta than you could ever imagine, because it is now the soundtrack for this challenge.
Shaheen's moment is definitely, like, the most unique out of what we're going to say, because it was actually, like, really incorporated into the episode. But Penner's exit in Philippines is just so fun because it's his last hurrah, and is like, you know, he's singing the outro music and he's like, goodbye, everyone. And he whistles the music down the steps. I'm not going to whistle it for you because I'm not great at whistling.
And we don't want that copyright strike.
Yeah, obviously. Copyright is going to notice my whistle and going to be like, that's from Survivor. Nope. But it's just such a, like, beautiful moment when he's like, all right, suck eggs, and then, like, whistles the Survivor tune as he walks down, and then, like, it rises in, like, the actual soundtrack, and, like, it's just, like, such a bow on his story.
I think that's the nice thing about it, is that it does feel like this finalized moment for a three-time player, right? Someone who had, we had seen, this was his third season in 12 seasons. We were kind of robbed short of him in Micronesia, and then we see him back in Philippines. He seems to be in a commanding position, but always kind of seemed to be on the back foot at the same time. And I think it's really important when we get our returning players back, and they just show that they love the game, and they love the show. And that's what Penner's demonstrating here, right? And obviously, Penner is a screenwriter. He understands all this aspect of everything, and he gets the television production side of the game, right? Like, he knows what he's doing here as he's leaving. But it's such a fun moment. And it is the type of fun moment you see from someone like Jonathan Penner. And that is why Jonathan Penner is such a fantastic character that we've had on Survivor. And he's my favorite player, in all honesty. It's because he has this sense about him. It's because he feels just like he's a part of Survivor. And he's acknowledging that by giving us that exit music for himself as he leaves. And like you said, that swell into the actual composition, it's just a perfect conclusion to his story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Unless we get him back in 50. That is not a conclusion anymore. But
no, but it's a conclusion on his previous story, because now I think he would be in a different Penner.
Yes, I believe it. I mean, it's a conclusion on his arc. We'll say it. Yeah. We'll put it that way.
For sure. Do you want to dive into our next moment?
This moment was one that this is, I feel like this moment is one where it really speaks to the excitement a player can have when it comes to Survivor and the production of Survivor and the meta narrative of Survivor, because this is Millennials versus Gen X. And it's when Jay and Will have gone off there. They're looking for the idol and Jay finally finds it. And in his confessional, he's just talking about the swell of music around him. He can hear it and he starts singing. And that it's such a great moment. And this is, I think, one of the more predominant instances we have of the music actually being in a confessional and being acknowledged like this. And it's interesting because we don't get the same, it's not really the same as what we get here, where it's, or with the Penner and the Shaheen situation, where it like goes into the score. Mm-hmm. It's Jay kind of like almost manifesting that moment itself.
Yeah.
Into being it, because Ancient Voices doesn't play when people find idols.
No.
Sorry
no.
to break it to you, Jay, but not a thing.
No, but he's like, I can hear the Survivor music now. And it's just like, he's just in his Survivor feels. And you can really just see him loving it, the game, and loving playing the game, that he can like hear Ancient Voices. Like, so the Survivor gods are glowing on him in this Ancient Voice light. And he's just like, I can hear it. I found this idol and I can hear it. And then starts like singing it for us in the audience. And it's just like this glorious moment.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And again, we have moments like this in the new era. And I think like it's more meta now in the new era. I think we're at a point where, yeah, okay, we're getting this. We have like the Dodo music. I can't remember exactly who it was in the new era, because I haven't revisited the new era yet, because we don't talk about it on the Rewind all that often. But there is that moment, right, where they're like, I know someone's searching for an idol. It's like, I know they're just going to play that stupid Dodo music. Like, where this guy's, they're going to highlight the idol, make it very obvious for everyone, and just like play this music to make me look like an idiot. That's fun. It's fun when Survivor gets to play with itself.
Yeah.
And that's something that the show's embraced. And I think it's really important for, after like, with 48 seasons of Survivor, 25 years on the air, it has to be willing to kind of poke fun at itself sometimes. And it helps that the players are willing to do that, but the editors have to as well. And I think it's really satisfying to us as viewers when we get to see these people care about the show just as much as we do, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Alrighty, everyone. Well, that's the show. We will still be having our Patreon on Saturday. We will be watching South Pacific Episode 4, Survivalism. Why are we watching a pre-merge when we're technically in the merge? Well, because, dear viewers, we got two boots. So we have Redemption Island and a vote out in South Pacific. We are divided into two tribes, essentially, here in the new era. So it's basically a pre-merge vote. So we have decided to justify it that way. And also, it has Shoulder the Load. So I just want to watch that challenge and South Pacific, because I love to torture John. So we will see you over on the Patreon. So watch that so you can listen to us. And John, what else do we got in the Specialist Universe?
Well, make sure you checked out that recap from Wednesday with Phil and Will talking about where we're kind of going in 48. Were these obvious boots? Were they less obvious boots? How strategic were these moves? Phil and Will break it all down for you over on Wednesday. Phil and Blake did Digging Deeper earlier today, and I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, so I don't know what they talked about. So head over there, listen to that. Maketa and Kyle also recapped The Amazing Race earlier today. Check that out. Phil is going to be joined by the one and only Ron Clark on Sunday for the Predictions and Power Rankings. It's going to be really fun. Ron Clark is a fantastic Survivor character, and I cannot wait to see his thoughts on 48 so far, leading up to the event he's hosting this week on Wednesday. And then, McKenna, you and Phil are at some point early next week finishing Australian Survivor.
Yes, Australian Survivor Brains versus Brawn 2 is finally coming to a close. It has been a gauntlet trying to get through it, but it's a good season, and if you haven't watched it, binge it now in this weekend so you can get caught up for the finale. It's a good time.
And then over on the Patreon, everything's going on. Every season matters, Q&As, casting perspective, us with the Survivor Rewind, and Phil's continuing his watch of Australian Survivor over there. McKenna, you are done with the Patreon for Australian Survivor after your Brains versus Brawn, though, right?
Yeah. And... yeah, you will not hear me talk about a previous season of Australian Survivor. So,
although if you did want to hear McKenna talk about Blood versus Water, which is the next season that Phil's covering, her and I actually already covered that over on the Patreon back when it first aired.
In depth version, yes, of it.
In depth, that is some intense.
Phil is about 20 minutes. We were about 2 hours.
So. Yeah. So if you really want the in depth Blood versus Water breakdown, go check that out. Make sure you like the video, subscribe to the channel so you know when everything's happening.
Catherine, we're so sorry you didn't get the notification, but make sure you click the bell so you know when we go live.
And then we'll be back next Friday to hopefully rewind an exciting episode. I think we're past the safe part of the merge now, and we get to the fun stuff now.
Well, because now they'll actually all be individuals and all merge technically. So we'll see you in the actual merge, everyone. Goodbye.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.